I'm Evan Kleinman of Angelique Cafe, and this is Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. How does an innocent bottle of water harm the environment? I'll tell you and get you considering tap water again. A delicious ramen place to try, courtesy of Pulitzer Prize winner Jonathan Gold. Can a guy giving out free ice cream change the world? He thinks so. More on that later today. The Silver Palette Cookbook turns 25. For a generation of people, it changed the way they cooked forever. I'll catch up with the two women who started it all. But first, let's see what's in season at the bountiful Santa Monica Farmers Market.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. We're visiting now with Jay Shipman, and he's a friend of Alex Weiser's, our potato and carrot farmer. Jay has actually got a very interesting profession. He is a specialist in carrots, and who knew this kind of thing existed? But he's been advising farmers like Alex what kind of carrots to plant, and then he's also an expert on soils and seeds and so forth. Alex has popularized the Nantes carrot, which is a sweet, crispy French carrot. But we also see now at the market yellow carrots, purple carrots, dark red carrots. And so, Jay, why don't you tell us, it's just an amazing, you are an expert in the field of carrots.
That's right.
So tell us a little bit about your company and then how you help small farmers like Alex.
Well, first of all, I work for a company which is a Dutch company based in Holland called Nunhems. And we specialize in carrots and onions and lots of other vegetables. Particularly carrots are an amazing vegetable, and then they have a real wide genetic background. So that's where you get all the colors from, the reds, purples with different color interiors, yellows, orange. So it's a real fun crop to work on. There's a lot of different types, a lot of different flavors.
You know, I know that there's big fields of carrots going in. Now, what do they use 500 acres of carrots for?
Carrot farming in California is very big. 80% of the carrots in the U.S. are grown in California alone. And most of those carrots go into your baby cut and peel types, which you see in the store, which are the short carrots that are peeled. Most of your large acreage is going into that. They try to use very sweet varieties with great consumer traits, great color, great texture, eating texture. They do their best to find the very best varieties as well. So
I heard that those weren't so much baby carrots. Those are big carrots. They were whittled down to the hard, to the core, which is kind of like a wood, more of a wooden. Are those really more tender?
Well, they don't whittle them to the core. That would be not a nice product. But they do cut a long product into small 2-inch pieces, and then from there they take off the rough edges with a polisher. But you're definitely, if you cut it, you'll definitely see that they have a very small core. That's one thing that we choose varieties for, is having the smallest undistinct core as possible. Now, the history of an orange carrot is actually Dutch. The Dutch's colors, or their family color, is orange, the House of Orange. So they took all the genetic material from carrots and developed selected orange carrots. And that's why the majority of our commercial carrots now are orange.
Well, what did they come from, the red and the yellow?
Yeah, probably the original color of carrots was probably purple, is what they think, or black.
This is so interesting, and it's great to find these kind of things here at the market. That was Jay Shipman. He is a carrot expert based here in Los Angeles, and he advises farmers big and small about what kind of new carrots to grow. We're visiting now with David West, and David is the wild mushroom forager who sells at the Santa Monica Saturday and Wednesday market, also at Hollywood on Sunday. And David is the harbinger of porcinis, and here they are.
This year, all the stars lined up for some reason, and we have probably the best porcini I've ever seen in the 12 to 15 years I've been doing this. The bad news is everything grew at once. So it's a beautiful crop, but it's all going to come due, and 3 weeks from now, 2 weeks from now, it'll be over. So the advice I have for people, especially when they're at the stand and they see them, they say, well, you have these next week. I shrug, and I'm like, I have them now. You want to get them now, because if not, maybe next May or June when you see them again.
Yeah, so this is like a classic mushroom. Looks like something out of Fantasia with the perfect cap top and the kind of the bulbous stem.
Exactly.
You're talking that cap can be up to, what, 8 inches across, maybe? 6-8 inches across?
12. The flavor described by myself and many other people is similar to, if you can imagine, a vegetarian foie gras. Mm. Very rich, almost like monkfish liver type, you know. These are great for sautéing up slowly, low heat, to do a pasta or a risotto, or to put over a steak, or just grill them and break that stem off there, cut the stem in half lengthwise, grill that with the cap.
And how do you know they're done? They just get soft and
dark?
You
know, people ask me this all the time, and it's a silly answer, but it's the answer. They look done. They get sort of shriveled up.
Yeah.
unfortunately, porcinis are good from their raw till they're fully cooked. So there really is no way of taking it off the grill too soon. If you're going to do pasta, I tell people to slice it thin and saute it.
Oh, okay.
A little bit of white wine and take some of the pasta water and throw it in there at the end and make a porcini sauce for your pasta. Here, look, here's our lunch. This is what Carl and I are doing for lunch today. Yeah, these are as hard as apples or potato. I mean, feel it. It's just, it's remarkable.
It's amazing. It is. You think it's going to be a soft, spongy mushroom,
but it's not. No, it's rock hard. So we're going to slice this, like out of this one mushroom, which I would describe as about a 3 or 4 ounce mushroom.
Right.
We're going to get probably 50 or 60 slices. We're going to shave it like it was a truffle over this nice bed of baby arugula that I stole from my neighboring farmer. And we're going to put some really high quality olive oil over this and salt, and that's going to be our lunch.
Oh, you're going to eat them raw?
Yeah.
So what time is lunch?
Lunch is, what time is it now?
All right, David, this is so beautiful. Now, okay, I'm going to rush over there. If I get these porcinis and I take them home, do I have to eat them, cook them right away?
Yeah, I tell people to treat both the morels and the porcini like fresh seafood. Okay. The fresher you eat it, the better it'll be.
All right, great. So, and how much are they?
They're between like $20 and $30 a pound. This is the best porcini I've seen in a long time.
Mm, beautiful. Well, thanks so much, David.
Thanks for stopping by.
All right, well, I'm going to enjoy these while they're here. That was David West, and he contracts with longtime, very loyal mushroom foragers up in the National Forest where these things grow wild. And like he was saying, it's a fabulous year for porcinis, and just to see them at the market, you will be inspired and moved to take some home and do something amazing with them. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Just a note, I have a couple spaces left in my cooking class from Trader Joe's tomorrow, June 3rd. If you're interested, please give me an email at evan@angelicafe.com. That's AngeliCaffe.com. Pulitzer Prize winner Jonathan Gold is Good Foods omnivore. He's back with us next to share a ramen noodle restaurant we've got to try. That's coming up when Good Food returns. It's time once again for our hit of instant gratification via Jonathan Gold, writer of counterintelligence columns for the Los Angeles Weekly, for which he recently won the Pulitzer Prize. Where are we going today, Jonathan?
We're going downtown.
And what are we going to find there?
We're going to find ramen in Little Tokyo, Weller Court.
Now, what does ramen mean? Is it always the same kind of noodle?
It's basically the same kind of noodle. It's a wheat noodle. Sometimes it's curly, sometimes it's straight, sometimes it's cooked soft, sometimes it's not. But it's basically the Japanese approximation of Chinese noodles.
And what's the name of the place we're going to?
We're going to a place called Orochan.
Orochan. And what do they specialize in?
Orochan is famous among chili heads in California because they specialize in something I've heard called hell ramen.
Hell ramen?
Or ramen that is spiced incredibly ferociously. You go into the restaurant and all types of people there, you know, Japanese punk rockers and a million college kids and a lot of European tourists for some reason. And the menu looks big, but there's basically one dish on the menu, which is to say the ramen. And it's available in 8 or 9 different intensities, from the lowest to what they call special 2.
Now, when you say different intensities, are you talking about heat or are you talking about funky pork flavor?
It's a fairly mild ramen when you get it the lowest level without the spices. It's bland. But when you go up from, you know, non-spicy to like impact, hyper, or extreme, it becomes more so. And the top one, which has a sign, eat at your own risk, is special 2. If you could eat special 2 with an entire bowl of special 2 within 30 minutes, including the bell peppers, then you get your picture taken and put on the wall.
Did you succeed?
I didn't.
Did you try?
I didn't try to finish the entire thing.
Is it spicy from chili powder or from
dried whole chilies or from fresh chilies?
I'm not exactly sure. I'm pretty sure that they have a paste in there that they'll ladle in depending to what kind of ramen you get. And there's definite spices in there. It's not just chilies. And it's not, at least it doesn't seem so, to have the chili extracts that will melt your teeth or the habanero chilies. It's just ordinary hot Japanese chilies.
Do they sell beer?
They sell lots of beer.
You
would be advised to order some and then to order some more. And you can also get things like, you know, edamame, the boiled soybeans, or dumplings, which aren't particularly great, or weird little asparagus salads, or things that are preludes to your bowl of throat-scorching ramen.
That sounds like really a fun thing to do, actually, when you're downtown. Give us the name and the address.
The name of the restaurant is Orochan Ramen, and it is in Weller Court, which is at 123 South Astronaut Onizuka Street, Little Tokyo.
What a great street name. What's the best way for approaching Weller Court?
Weller Court is very near the corner of Los Angeles Street and 2nd Street, and there's a big parking lot across the street that's not very expensive.
Pulitzer Prize winner Jonathan Gold joins Good Food most every week with his restaurant finds. You can read his reviews each week in the LA Weekly. Past recommendations are online at kcrw.com/goodfood. Free food makes people happy. Free ice cream? That can cause a stampede. Next, I'll introduce you to the ice cream man. He's driving across the country handing out free ice cream. Why? I'll let him tell you next when Good Food returns. Your ideal job be? Well, I imagine that driving around to music festivals to give away thousands of ice cream treats would be right up there. Matt Allen is the ice cream man, and he's figured out a way to make a living handing out free ice cream. You really have to admire that. Welcome.
Hello.
So tell us what you do and why you do it.
I travel the country and give away free ice cream, and I'm trying to find a way to travel the world and give away 500,000 free ice cream.
Have you always been attracted to ice cream?
More so adventure, I would say, in journey. I do have a pretty mean sweet tooth.
Give us a prototypical day of what you do. if there could be such a thing.
When I'm not on tour, it's probably like a lot of other people in the sense I find myself in front of a computer way more often than I ever would have thought. I didn't necessarily think it would take so much time on the computer answering emails and updating stuff at icecreamman.com and just trying to get sponsors and stuff like that.
Sponsorship is sort of the key to enable you to be this giant karma bomb and give away free ice cream, right?
Yes. I'm very fortunate. Guitar Center has been on board since day one. And then also there's a company, Jack Prints, out of Cleveland, does a lot of printing for us. So we get our stickers and stuff. And then Warner Brothers, we work with them, and White Stripes. Levi's just jumped on board, so they're going to help out for the summer rest of the year, which is a huge blessing.
So describe what it is you do when you're on tour. What is that?
Well, basically, my ice cream truck is Bessie. She's a 1969 ice cream truck, and I will be traveling the country for about 4 months, hitting up most of the major music festivals, as well as doing a lot of other ice cream socials. We'll be at St. Jude Children's Hospital in Memphis when we get there.
And what is an ice cream social?
Just a whole lot of free ice cream. Basically, it's nice because with an ice cream truck and giving away free ice cream, it's very self-contained. And so all you have to do is roll up with an ice cream truck and maybe play some music and, you know, people know you're there, or even if they don't and they come by. And it's kind of one of those things that I used to say a lot, that it's hard to give away free ice cream, which people doubted.
Because people don't understand why you're doing it?
People don't understand, and obviously people don't assume that it's free. There was a stretch where I pulled out my little digital camera and filmed myself and said, okay, I've said that it's hard to give away free ice cream and no one ever believes me. And then I started to pan out and I showed, you know, thousands of people and I'm standing at the truck. You know, we don't have big signs on the truck that say free ice cream. Sometimes if it's slow, we'll yell it. But a lot of times I want people who want the ice cream to get it and get it for free as opposed to somebody who just wants something for free.
Do the promoters of events invite you to be a part of the event or do you sort of make a guerrilla sort of attachment to the event?
No. We try to do everything officially with the promoters and the production company. It's just so much easier. And it's, I think, kind of a human feeling. It's nice to be wanted. It's just nice to have that, you know, when people get excited when you show up as opposed to, uh-oh, here's Ice Cream Man trying to give away ice cream again, which can make it very tricky. But we're very easy to work with. I like to think we are, especially for the festivals that want us there, because we don't ask for anything except for a parking space and passes for our crew.
And do you private label the ice cream or does the ice cream come from a particular ice cream maker or are you pretty varied in your tastes of what you give away?
We've worked with numerous ice cream companies, Julie's Organic up in Oregon, Mochi Ice Cream here in L.A., Rich's, Matterhorn Ice Cream. But a lot of it is it's been hard for us to find a company that can supply our needs on a national level and actually international too. We'll be in Canada next weekend.
How many ice cream treats do you give away?
We've given away over 85,000 so far.
Once you reach your goal of giving away 500,000 treats, are you going to continue doing it?
No. I like to live on a project basis. I've done things like I've walked from Mexico to Canada. I've rode my bike from Long Beach, California to Maine. For Ice Cream Man, for instance, it's a 6 or 7 year project. But after that, no, I would like for Ice Cream Man as an entity to continue in whatever shape or form it is. I would actually like it in a perfect world to be self-sustaining and actually bring in some money so that we can fund other projects.
Thank you for coming.
You're welcome.
Matt Allen is the Ice Cream Man. He's driving across the country handing out free ice cream. You can follow his trail of ice cream on our website at kcrw.com/goodfood. If you follow the trail of curry, it leads much farther than India. Next, a taste of curry through Japan, Portugal, and Fiji. That's when Good Food returns. Addicted to good Indian food. The complexity of the spicing combined with an unending love of vegetables and legumes in all forms is seductive. But where did curry, the dish we all love, originate? Is it truly, deeply Indian? Lizzie Collingham tackles this question in her book, Curry, A Tale of Cooks and Conquerors. Welcome to the show, Lizzie.
Oh, thank you.
So is curry Indian?
Well, it's really hard to answer the question. People always ask me whether they're eating authentic Indian food, and the answer to that is, what would that be? There isn't really an authentic Indian food, so curry is just one of many forms.
Why do you say that there isn't an authentic Indian food?
Well, the point about Indian food is that it's a mix of many different cultures, types of food, all being brought into the subcontinent and getting muddled up in this wonderful mixture. So the Persians brought food from Central Asia and Persia. The Portuguese brought their own dishes. The British brought some dishes with them, maybe not the best.
What about the word curry? Where did it come from and what was the dish that was christened with that name?
Well, curry is what the Portuguese, when they first arrived in 1498 in India, they looked around and said, these people eat some sort of funny dishes and they're made with spices in butter and it's stewed up, and that seems to be called karil or curry. But actually they picked up a South Indian word, which didn't mean all dishes that we eat. They meant a specific spice mixture or a specific meat dish. But these words got picked up by the Portuguese and applied generically to everything Indians ate. And then when the British arrived, they picked up that word from the Portuguese and said, oh, the Indians eat curry or curry, and then they turned it into the word curry.
Did curry powder come about when the British came?
Well, the point is, the British loved Indian food, and they would always sit down and have curries on the table when they first got to India. They absolutely adored it. And they would have the specific dishes like biryani, rogan josh, and so on. The cooks would make them specific dishes. And then they wanted to take those recipes back with them, so they would ask the cooks to write the recipe out. But it was difficult to get all these different spice mixtures to go in food. So they'd quite often say, oh, well, just give me a mixture for all the spices. And then they would just use that one mixture for all their Indian dishes and put what they called then curry powder into chicken dishes, meat dishes, fish dishes, and so on. And then it just sort of got transmuted into curry and curry powder.
When I think about the British first coming to India, I think of a people who were eating dishes that were very bland, very predictable, very meat heavy. And so they were gifted with an enlightenment of their cuisine that they came to love. Was there anything they left behind in the Indian cuisine?
Well, you're right about, you know, the idea that of the British contributing anything to Indian cuisine seems quite laughable. In fact, I get comments from people really angry when I claim that they did make any sort of contribution whatsoever. But really, they did. They loved roast meat. Now, Indian cooks would take roast meat and they would plaster the roasts in spices, so you get these lovely spicy masala dishes. The most important thing I think they left behind was European vegetables. They introduced cauliflowers and beans and American things like potatoes, tomatoes, all things that we can't really imagine Indian food without, and tea, which I thought was the most unexpected thing when I was doing the research. The British taught Indians how to drink tea, not the other way around.
But Indians grew the tea, correct?
That's right. The British found tea growing in India. They were worried that the Chinese their monopoly on Chinese tea was about to come to an end, so they decided to actually cultivate it. Now, the Indians didn't really drink it. It was a medicine. It wasn't something you would drink yourself. And the British set up a tea industry. It took a long time to get going. But finally, by the end of the 19th century, they actually did have good tea growing in India, which they exported to Australia and back to Britain. But the Indians still weren't interested in drinking it, so they set up this incredible marketing campaign. They would actually go from door to door, knocking on Indian people's houses, and they would bring in a kettle and jugs and cups and teapots and show them how to make it, and go back once a week for several months until they finally persuaded the household to drink tea. But of course, the Indians couldn't just drink plain tea. Then they changed it into this lovely spicy chai, where you boil up the tea with cardamom and cloves and ginger and cinnamon and the milk and the sugar, and you get this lovely sweet chai, which I think you can get in Starbucks these days.
Pretty incredible story. I love that. Now, also the other thing I think about the British being faced with dining in India is that they were very buttoned up. I mean, just their clothing seems like it wouldn't go well in that sort of tropical, humid climate.
Absolutely. Very uncomfortable. Fortunately, when they arrived in the late 18th, early 19th century, there was an etiquette that you could go in a white suit and you could take off your jacket and then you could dine in your shirt sleeves. But as they got more buttoned up, as they got more worried about being representatives of Britishness, they had to go to dinner in black evening suits, and they must have absolutely sweltered. The women would have had to go in their tight dresses and so on, and it would have been boiling hot. It would have been even worse because all the servants would have been crowded around. Everybody bought their own servants, and then all these servants would stand around giving them the food, preparing their hookah, their hubble bubble pipe, which they might smoke even during the meal, which would also be a bit smelly. And polite people don't tend to mention this, but flies and cockroaches might fly in and get muddled up, attracted by the light. It was quite a trying affair.
Now, I understand that there was a particular delicacy that we would just be horrified to be presented with, and that is a roasted black rat. Could that be true?
That's a recipe from a 12th century text, though. In the 12th century, southern Indian kings and ordinary Hindus even would have eaten quite strange meats, what we would consider odd meats. So lizards and tortoise, supposed to taste a bit like banana. But this recipe for black rat comes from a text on how to be a good king. And one of the things that made you a good king was eating well and eating meat to make you manly. And the black rat you would take, you'd put it in hot oil so the fur came off, sprinkle it with salt and cumin, roast it, and it was supposed to be one of this king's favorite dishes. But black rat would not be eaten in India today.
What's your favorite curry?
I like all curries. I basically eat any curry that's given to me. I think my favorite recipe from India is the green coriander chutney, which is fresh green coriander mixed with coconut milk, a bit of garlic, a few peanuts, some salt to give it a bit of bite. And I first had that staying with a family in Madras, and it was my first introduction to southern Indian food. You eat it for breakfast with idlis, which are like a spongy rice flour cake, very neutral flavor, and you dip it in the chutney, and it's absolutely heavenly.
Lizzie, thank you so much. It's a lovely book, and I've so enjoyed talking with you.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Curry, A Tale of Cooks and Conquerors is Lizzie Collingham's book. It's a delicious read. Next on Good Food, how a simple bottle of water served at a restaurant can spew out more carbon than a diesel truck. That's in 1 minute right here on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Menu is a phrase we'll be hearing more and more in the coming months. What is it? If you think it's a menu with sturdy plastic covers, then think again. Neil Frazier, chef owner of local restaurants Grace and BLD, has introduced a special menu at Grace that he's calling Close to Home. So nice to have you here.
So nice to be here.
So what is the sustainable menu?
The sustainable menu is going to be featured right now as a prefix tasting menu Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday at Grace. And my idea was to try to cut down on the carbon used in order to produce my menu, thus trying to find products that are more local and not necessarily indigenous, but you know, closer to my restaurant. We started with a 400 to a 450-mile footprint, trying to source 90% of the products, the wine and the food from that region.
How does buying locally reduce the carbon footprint?
Well, let's just say we're talking about water. I'm going to buy a case of water that's probably – you know, at the source, they sell for, you know, minus 10 cents because it's government subsidized. And they put it in a bottle, which is, say, I buy Italian water right now. The glass is made in China. So that glass comes in a boat from China to Italy. It's bottled at the source, of course. And they put a metal cap on it that's probably made in Taiwan. And they put it in a cardboard box, which is made in Israel. And they put it on another container and they ship it to America. And of course, it doesn't come to Los Angeles. It comes to New York. And it's loaded off a ship. And it's not put on a train, it's put on a truck. It goes to one place and that other person buys it from someone else and that other person delivers it to me. And then all of a sudden at the end of the day, I also have an empty bottle to deal with. And all of that is creating, you know, we need energy in order to do that.
So by buying locally, you completely cut out all of that transportation?
I don't cut out all of it. I mean, obviously, you know, there's a certain amount of energy that takes from, you know, wherever that water comes from, whether it's from the Sierra Nevada or whether it's from the Colorado River. What we're considering doing now is not selling bottled water. And, you know, the issue for us, you know, we make a fair amount of profit off of water. Restaurants spend a lot of money buying alcohol and buying water. And, you know, for the same cent, buying wine is cheaper to buy and it's less labor involved. It's not like, you know, you have to train somebody for 5 years in order to open up a bottle of water. You know, it's a much easier process than sautéing foie gras. So it's a good profit source for us. And we buy a bottle of water for, you know, $1 or $1.20, and we sell it for $6. You know, one thing we've done since we opened Grace and also at BLD is we serve reverse osmosis water at both restaurants. We don't charge our customer for that. That's
You're talking about a still water.
Our still water.
But then don't you lose money selling, losing the sales of the bottled water?
Absolutely. And I think it's something you need to charge people for. And if people get it, they get it. And if they don't, then they don't. Yeah. It's like you want to, you know, do you want to destroy the planet or do you not want to destroy the planet? And at a certain price point, I think it, you know, sometimes it makes sense.
So when you first started, what kind of radius did you decide on?
I decided that in order to get the products that I felt like my customers would want, I would have to at least include Northern California.
When you get some of these products from Northern California, the proteins in particular, is it harder for you to deal with them? Do they come in bigger cuts? Do you have to do more breaking down, or is it pretty much the same as it's always been?
At first, it was a little bigger and, you know, whole loins. But as you get a couple months into it, people start to learn how to better, you know, suit the product to deal with your needs. Obviously, you know, giving me a 450-pound pig for a 90-seat restaurant, it's going to take me a while.
Yeah.
But I buy the bellies, I buy the loins, I buy shoulders.
Now, we have an ocean right near us here where we're sitting.
We do.
Can you use the Southern California ocean to source fish and shellfish?
Absolutely. The first tasting menu, or maybe the second tasting menu I ran, I ran most of my seafood was one from within maybe a 200-mile radius. I think the most north was sand abs from Morro Bay, Santa Barbara prawns, and then even closer, Point Juanimi is actually cultivating abalone now.
And to get locally fished seafood that close, did you have to go direct to fishermen? Or there, again, are there special purveyors now that are starting to be more in line with the fact that some of us might want to serve more locally sourced items?
You know, I'm fortunate that I have great relationships with my purveyors and my fish purveyor, Julie Harmon and Ocean Jewels, who I've used pretty much exclusively for the last 15 years. You know, if I ask people to do things, they have a much better relationship and a much better chance than me kind of getting on the phone trying to call Ventura Harbor going, what do you guys have on the ship today? So luckily, she's been able to source those things for me. And it's a matter of, you know, I ask them and then all of a sudden they have a new product and they offer that product to other restaurants. And then all of a sudden there's a market for it. And then as, you know, I'm not the only restaurant in Los Angeles that, you know, serves Point Juanimi abalone. Now there's 10. Now more people are often to actually buy it.
Now, what about the financial situation for you? Is sourcing things locally, is it actually more expensive or less expensive?
It's more expensive.
That's so interesting to me. Now, why would that be?
It's supply and demand. Small supply, small demand, it's expensive. You know, you get a pig from a place where they grow 200 million pigs a day and they, you know, bring them out on trucks, you know, 7 days a week to Los Angeles. It's a very relatively inexpensive product. Where you're actually talking to the farmer on Tuesday, he's slaughtering the animals on Wednesday, he's bringing them down the following week. That's a much different thing. I mean, we're talking about two pigs comparison to 200 pigs.
Now, what about organic? Because to me, local and organic are sort of two ends of a similar paradigm.
Sure. I mean, I think that organic is basically a brand, and organic is something you have to buy into. It's something you have to be certified for. It's something that costs farmers money. And a lot of farmers, because, you know, they have a big scale, they grow $20 million of the produce, it's very easy for them to comply to that. For a small farmer, sometimes it doesn't make economic sense to be organic.
In fact, a lot of farmers that we buy from are farming with total organic practices.
But they're not advertising that.
But they're not advertising.
They're doing it because they care. I'm serving reverse osmosis water at my restaurants because I care. It's not on the menu. I'm serving RO water because I don't want to serve my customers lead.
Now, what about your cars? Are they running on vegetable oil?
I have one car running on vegetable oil right now, and I'm planning on trading my other one in for a new Mercedes.
And a new Mercedes would be an advantage because?
Mercedes, there's a couple places in Los Angeles that do conversions, and they work mainly with Mercedes. So it's almost like having the support group on it. And it just made so much sense. And then I could use a product that is a carbon neutral product that, you know, is basically growing in my kitchen every day that I throw into a dumpster and I have to pay to have it hauled away. And all of a sudden, you know, that grease barrel in the back, you know, I don't have any oil in it anymore. I have animal fat in it. That's it. And the rest of it goes into my car.
That is so great.
Yeah.
Neil, it's been really wonderful talking to you.
Thank you.
That was Neil Frazier. He's the chef owner of Grace. And BLD, he's doing a lot of interesting things at his places. We'll have a link to his websites from our website, kcrw.com/goodfood.
Speaking of sustainability in the way we eat, what about organics? How did the organic movement begin and how did it take hold? I'll be back with the answers. Stay tuned to Good Food on KCRW. Organic used to mean one thing. Now it's starting to mean quite another. And many of us are beginning to wonder exactly how weird the new, quote, organic, unquote, will be. Sam Fromarts is the author of Organic Inc., Natural Foods and How They Grew. The book tells the saga of the rise and fall of organic food as it's made its way into the American mainstream. Welcome.
Great to be here.
How has the term organic morphed from a small, sort of very trustworthy movement into this multi-billion dollar industry?
Basically, what happened is organic foods did start out small, mostly locally on small farms, sold in food co-ops and natural food stores. And the thing about it was that it succeeded beyond its wildest imagination. And right now, consumers, you know, of all walks of life are buying the food, and it's overwhelming the capacity of farmers to produce it, and it's creating this market that much bigger food companies are interested in because it's a growing food marketplace.
Let's talk about a couple products that I think are kind of emblematic of what we think of as being organic and how the mass nature of the new market has sort of changed the product. Spring Mix, the ubiquitous lettuce mix, which in my mind sort of began with Alice Waters and her mesclun.
Right. Well, it's an interesting product. I mean, it's, you know, it started off as mesclun mix, you know, using the French term, and it morphed into spring mix. It's been called yuppie chow. You know, it's had all various names. The most interesting thing about the product was the bag salad that you now see in the supermarket, not just organic, but conventional. That product was really invented by an organic food company. You know, what it did was really change the way Americans perceive and eat salad. In fact, I just had a friend over the other day who has four kids, and she said, "Isn't that an amazing product? I mean, I just take it out of the bag and, you know, and I can use it." And for someone with four kids and very little time, it, you know, was this amazing innovation. But at the same time, it really moved away from, I think, what Alice Waters imagined when she was using it as a signature dish at Chez Panisse, you know, this little plate of salad greens, and has basically moved all the way into McDonald's, where you see these specialty greens in their salads as well.
For me, it's a particularly interesting product because it's so easy to forget what it's really supposed to be like. I know that recently I went to the farmer's market and I actually bought some spring mix straight from a farmer and took it home. And I said to myself, oh man, I mean, it's so different. It's not as soft. You see the varieties each sort of speak to you in a more direct way. They're not that little flaccid leaf that makes you just want to eat iceberg lettuce because it has no texture.
Right. Well, there's definitely a trade-off, you know, and there always is, you know, between convenience and quality. And, you know, I found this writing my book where I spent so much time looking into salad mix and visiting farmers and, you know, trying various blends that I ended up growing it myself in a community garden here in Washington, D.C. And, you know, I would pick it out of the ground at 5 in the evening, come home and wash it and put it in the salad bowl. And I was like, aha, that's the way it's supposed to be, you know.
Now let's talk about another product, which is for me often the poster child of pesticide, which would be the strawberry. Tell us the horrifying fact that you write about in your book.
Well, strawberries, you know, if you look at these lists of the foods with the most pesticides residues on them, fruits often come at the top and strawberries and, you know, they're not alone. Peaches are up there too, you know, often have the most residues on them. But what I didn't know was the way strawberries were produced, which involves blasting the soil with a fumigant, which is actually a neurotoxin. And so the people who work with this chemical have to wear body suits and gas masks, and plastic is put over the soil so that the gas doesn't escape.
Are you referring to methylbromide?
That's right, yeah. And a component of it is one of the ingredients in tear gas. So you kind of see what we're talking about here. And that I didn't know. And the reason we don't hear about it is because that chemical, the saving grace of it, is it doesn't exist as a food residue on the fruit. What happens is it evaporates into the air and destroys the ozone layer, which is why it is gradually being phased out.
I know that here in Southern California, a farmer that's much beloved in our local markets, Phil McGrath, has managed to figure out how to grow strawberries organically. You have a story about Swantonberry Farms. Could you share that with us?
Yeah, it was quite interesting because Swantonberry, which is run by a fellow named Jim Cochran, they were the first farm on the central coast of California, or one of the first, I should say, to begin growing strawberries organically. And at that time, he was told it couldn't be done. And actually, chemical manufacturers visited his farm and said they would fumigate his fields for free. But he went on and tried it. And the tricky thing is, to deal with these soil diseases, you have to rotate your strawberries with other crops so they're not growing in the same soil year after year. And he was able to figure that process out and bring in, really through trial and error, the use of broccoli, which, because of the nature of the plant, it actually destroyed these diseases in the soil. And he found that if he followed strawberries after the broccoli was harvested, he would avoid the diseases. And so that became a key part of his rotation and actually is a pretty common rotation now in organic strawberry production.
Now, do you consider this book that you've written to be a warning to the average consumer?
No. What I really wanted to do was to educate the consumer about what they're buying and what organic really means. You know, I came away from it, having spent 2 years on the project, really encouraged about what organic farmers were doing. I really saw that as a possibility in farming and food production, that it was very real.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Sam Fromarts is a business journalist. He's written Organic Inc., Natural Foods and How They Grow. Organic foods aren't the only thing that caused a revolution in the way we eat. The Silver Palette Cookbook caused a bit of one 25 years ago. Next, I'll talk with the authors of this book about the birth of the boomer cuisine they spawned. That's when Good Food returns on KCRW. Of a certain age, the Silver Palette Cookbook is a truly beloved classic that changed not only the way we cooked, but also the way we entertained. It came along at a time when being a, quote, gourmet, unquote, often meant slavish hours in the kitchen with strange ingredients and unfamiliar techniques, a recipe for failure if there ever was one. Julie Rosso and Sheila Lukens showed us another way. Their recipes were simple yet fresh. They encouraged us to use fresh seasonal ingredients, artisanal breads and cheeses. An encounter with the Silver Palette made it seem as if we'd been entertaining in this smart, sophisticated way forever. Well, 25 years have passed, and the Silver Palette has been included in the James Beard Who's Who of American Food and was inducted into the Cookbook Hall of Fame. The book is currently being reissued to commemorate its 25th anniversary, and I am delighted to have Julie Rosso and Sheila Lukens with me in the studio this morning. Welcome, ladies.
It's great to be here.
Now, how did you evolve the style of food that you came to present, first in the shop and then in the book?
This is Sheila.
This is Julie.
Well, first of all, it was good home cooking. That was number one. And number two, we used familiar ingredients in unusual combinations.
But we had both traveled a lot, and I think we one thing we have always agreed on is flavor. I mean, we just like big flavors so that when you taste something, you go, wow, that's the best thing I've ever tasted. And that's a, once we agreed on that, everything else fell into place. It was simple.
Did you have an experience in the shop where a particular food just exploded? One of the things that you made, some kind of chicken, and then all of a sudden you knew that everyone in New York City was buying this one thing.
That was chicken Marbella. Yes, but it worked for a number of reasons. Yes, the flavors were phenomenal.
What was in it?
What was in it was chicken, of course, and marinated overnight. Lots of garlic, pureed garlic, oregano, capers with a little caper juice, red wine vinegar, olive oil, bay leaves, prunes, pitted olives, Spanish olives.
I remember making that for the first time.
And then when you baked it, I'm sorry, sprinkled with a little brown sugar and a little white wine in the bottom of the pan.
A killer dish.
Well, and those were the days when, you know, the consensus was Americans don't like prunes and olives. So it was a surprise to everyone. However, there are like, you know, jillions of signature dishes that people have sort of incorporated into their family traditions and their seasonal cooking. So that there's a lot more to that book besides chicken Marbella. But that was somehow the recipe that people started with and started talking about early on.
That one, and for me, one of the emblematic recipes was the carrots and the raspberry vinegar. I had always seen raspberry vinegar, and I thought, what would I do with that? And then I got that recipe, and I tossed them, boiled the carrots, tossed them, and I went, oh, man, these are smart ladies. You were also two of the first to actually take the actual recipes of an existing business and just lay them out there in your cookbook for everyone to see. Did people get scared that you were going to do this?
This is Sheila.
Sheila got scared.
Sheila panicked. Sheila thought, I don't want to do this because if I do this, nobody's going to come to the store and buy our food.
Well, there's a step that you've missed, which is we created a product line of condiments, mustards and chutneys and raspberry vinegar and blueberry vinegar and, oh, spiced nuts and sweet sauces, and it went on and on. In fact, we got a little carried away, and at one point we had 150 products, and one of our lawyers said, no, girls, no, too much inventory. So really, the book, in my mind, was to promote the products so that people across the country, we ultimately were selling a couple of thousand stores, that they could really understand who these two women were in New York City and give us some validity, you know?
Are there any dishes from the book, any recipes that you still make, that you still love, that if it's served to you by someone else, you're happy and you smile?
Or served in our own kitchen, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, things like tarragon chicken salad or salmon mousse or chili for a crowd or the linguine with tomatoes and basil and brie. I mean, they taste as good to us, and they're part of our seasonal cooking as they did then.
What you about know? You?
Sheila here. Yeah. Sheila loves rice and vegetable salad. I make that several times a year. I think it's great. And I think it's wonderful to serve if you're just serving a plain fillet of beef.
You know what's really interesting, though, as I'm sitting here across from you looking at the two of you, people know your products, people know the books, but you resisted using yourselves visually as sort of like star celebrities. It's very different than now. Did you do that on purpose? You sort of kept yourselves in the background and you let the products speak for themselves?
We wanted the products to speak for themselves.
I don't know if we would have done that today, because if you look at some older pictures of us, we looked great.
Well, you know, we needed to speak to people who were buying blueberry chutney. You know, first of all, we sent people all over the country to stand in Saks Fifth Avenue or Crate and Barrel and taste out blueberry chutney so people would know what it was. But we did a little newsletter that we'd send to the stores that were buying our products. So we were there in essence, just our picture wasn't blasted all over the place. You know, we wanted people to understand the products.
What legacy would you like the Silver Palette Cookbook to leave to the culinary world?
I'd like it to be that cooking is fun. Cooking is all about sharing, having fun, take a recipe, make it familiar so you feel comfortable with it, and then make it your own. I mean, to me, I tend to think I have an insatiable curiosity, and that's why I love cooking, because it's different all the time. There's always something new and different. And if there isn't, you can still make different combinations and cook it differently and learn constantly.
My thoughts exactly. And you, Miss Sheila?
Miss Sheila thinks the recipes are great. And so I do like people to learn from the recipes, and then they can go on their own from there, not to really change our recipes a lot. I think the recipes are great. But then become real cooks after that, you know.
Well, I want to thank the two of you. I mean, it's so interesting because you were one of the first to create a world that now is the world of food that we live in. You should be very proud.
Well, thank you very much for saying that. That's so great.
Sheila Lukens and Julie Rosso wrote the Silver Palette Cookbook 25 years ago. It's celebrating its silver anniversary. It's one of those few cookbooks that mark a generation. Next, whether fancy or basic, an oven is an oven, yes? Well, not so anymore. Let me introduce you to TurboChef, the oven I covet. It can cook a 12-pound turkey in 42 minutes, about 15 times faster than a regular oven. That's coming up on Good Food. Those of us who are always searching for the latest in gastroporn acquisitions were thrilled when we read about the latest must-have entrant in the New York Times. It's TurboChef's double-wall speed cook oven. This latest cooking tool promises souffles in 2 minutes and perfect roast chickens in 14. So, of course, the article wasn't enough for me. I wanted more. So Steve Becerra is with us this morning. Steve is Chief Branding Officer for TurboChef Technologies, a company that designs, manufactures, and markets a variety of speed cooking solutions. So for people who were not lucky enough to see the picture of this gorgeous thing and read about it in the New York Times, how is it different from the kind of speedy solutions we are used to having in our home?
It's essentially real cooking at up to 15 times faster than conventional ovens. And a second element of differentiation is the design. In fact, we've heard consumers refer to it as a vintage Italian sports car in their kitchen. It has these very beautiful curves and a very distinctive hearth-shaped top door window. And it's very attractive and very fresh looking.
But it's very computer-based. There are a lot of presets. So what is involved? Is it a regular oven with bursts of air or bursts of microwave?
Well, what airspeed technology is if you were to imagine the cavity of the top oven, at the bottom of the cavity and the top of the cavity are a series and a grid of these small holes, roughly the size of a dime. And I guess there's about 85 of these holes in the top and bottom of the cavity. And out of each of those cavities comes this very elegant tornado of heated air. And so that heated air rapidly circulates throughout the cavity and around the food product at speeds up to 60 miles an hour. So it's with that speed that we very precisely and evenly control the cooking process. Now, at the same time, as an assisting technology, there is some microwave energy. And that microwave energy, just in very select ways, has precise bursts of microwave that invigorates the water molecules in the food product. And those two energies combined really enable the oven to cook at these unprecedented times and temperatures.
If a person were confronted with this oven and the dials, would it look like something that you would really need to take a manual out and feel sort of like an engineer to be able to use, or is it fairly intuitive?
Well, that's a great question. And the interface and the intuitiveness are critical to the user's ability to pick it up quickly and of course, use it. So we hired a design firm in San Francisco called Frog Design, and they helped us with the user interface so that anyone could work and control the oven without having to read a manual. It's a beautiful computer screen, the same quality of computer screen that you have at your workstation, brilliant colors and very sharp and clear. It essentially gives the user prompts and asks you questions on what you are cooking and what is the weight, and the oven essentially figures out the time and temperature for you. So there's no calculation. It's very easy to use. It has very simple cues that the user answers.
But what if after doing that one time, it isn't quite the way you want it? Can you go in and reprogram that preset? And how hard is that? Is it just a question of deciding to dial back the time or dialing up the time?
Well, Evan, that's a very good question. The computer controls and the algorithms have already been established by a team of food experts, culinarians and food scientists. However, for those who want to add their personal magic, you are able to go into the algorithms and almost like a camera today that would have a manual mode and an automatic mode. You're able to do that with this oven as well, and that is to take it into the expert mode, if you will, and change the levels of airspeed and change the levels of microwave to your customized choice.
The oven comes in different configurations, and in the configuration I've seen most often, it's a two-oven piece. Is the bottom oven also this AirSpeed technology, or is it just a regular oven?
It is not the AirSpeed technology. That's only available in the top cooking cavity. But in the lower cooking cavity on the TurboChef 30-inch double-wall oven, the lower oven is a 3-in-1 that it can be set at conventional cooking, convection, and then, interestingly, as a warming drawer.
And will a 25-pound turkey fit into it?
It does, as a matter of fact. That was one of the measures of the size of the cavity for the speed cook chamber. And, for example, a 12-pound turkey, which would normally take about 4 hours in a conventional oven, and the TurboChef cooks in 42 minutes.
Unbelievable. Thank you so much. I can't wait to get to be around where one is so I can watch how it works. Thanks so much, Steve.
You're quite welcome, and thanks. Great speaking with you today.
Steve Bashura is from TurboChef, a company that's produced a new gourmet oven that got me really intrigued when I first heard about it. I've got pictures of the TurboChef online at ksrw.com/goodfood. Sign up for our weekly Good Food newsletter and find every week's show. You can stream Good Food, download weeks of shows, and watch the latest video podcast. Find it all on ksrw.com/goodfood. Good Food's executive producer is Jennifer Farrell. The show is produced by Thea Challoner with Bob Carlson, Candace Moyer, Connie Alvarez, and Holly Tarson. The music supervisor is Gary Masiha. Special thanks to Beth Xavier. I'm Evan Kleiman. Join us next week for another edition of Good Food.